Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today I had with me via Zoom Fred Hoke. Fred is the co-founder and general partner at TechNexus, a Chicago-based venture collaborative that bridges the gap between startups and Fortune 100 and Fortune 500 corporations. Fred's career has taken him across the globe and back, and with over 30 years of experience, he's been at the forefront of the tech industry from the early days of the internet to the rise of SaaS. At TechNexus, Fred has orchestrated 270 investments for major corporations with an impressive 85% survival rate. As well as his work at TechNexus, he currently sits on the boards of numerous startups and the UIC School of Engineering, Chicago Next, and Smart Bet charities. In today's episode, we talk about building communities and driving the evolution of software as a service, moving from the theater of corporate innovation to investing beyond the check, how breaking out of the corporation may help you to bring in the entrepreneurial spirit, how corporations that focus too much on ROI of corporate venturing are missing a trick, and how CFOs are the wrong people to champion innovation within a corporation, why VC has been broken for 40 years and whether it's heading back on track, the fact that ventures are opportunities rather than threats for large corporations, and can you actually be contrarian in today's world? Let's get straight into it. This is Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah, the podcast where I talk to the people behind the stories that make the venture capital ecosystem go round. I've been working with startups from pre-seed to Series C for the last decade, and companies that I've worked with have gone on to realize value and exit or raise funds in excess of $500 million. I really hope you enjoy the episode, and if you have a guest that you'd love to see me have on, or you have a comment on any of the episodes that I've recorded so far, do reach out to me on LinkedIn or Twitter. I'd love to hear from you. Let's get straight into it. Fred, really great to have you with me via Zoom. So I want to get straight into it because I think we've got quite a lot to cover here. You've been pioneering corporate venture capital with TechNexus for close to two decades now. So could you share how your approach to CVC, corporate venture capital, has evolved over the years and what key factors have contributed to this incredible success rate you've had with, you know, 270 investments and a really impressive 85% survival rate?
Thank you. Well, two decades seems like I'm really old, so I'll pretend it's not that. It's not two decades. Yeah. But, you know, I think from my background, historically, I had built software companies, built technology companies, built communities. I was the evangelist for the software industry for a while, working all over the country to drive, at the time, what was the evolution to software as a service. But getting to the core we're talking about here, we've always seen corporations say, I want to engage startups. I want to understand them. I want to talk to them. Mainly for, you know, a lot of times it's periphery, right? It's, hey, I want to look cool, or I want to be perceived from a public standpoint that I'm being innovative. And early on, we did a lot of that work to say, okay, how do we make that happen? How do we make that theater happen, really? And really, that's what it was. It was a lot of theater. Over the last 7 years, though, we found a way to say, let's stop being about theater, let's stop being about the perfunctory, and let's really get down to brass tacks about how we get starters and corporations to work. And that begins with thinking of it as a relationship, not just an investment. So we use the term investing beyond the check, and it means that corporations shouldn't just look at a startup as a way to make a quick buck, or think about, not quick buck's the wrong word, but to think about it as an investment, but also think about it as a strategic investment, an investment that is about their future, about products and services, about new markets. And in order to do that, though, you have to dig deep, right? You have to get into a deep program that says, we're going to build a collaboration on an ongoing basis. We're going to be champions for that startup. And the startup has to think, I'm going to be a part of the entrepreneurial army that supports that corporation in a meaningful way.
So I guess there's a couple of questions that I have from that. And yeah. I love that phrase, investing beyond the check, right? But so when we think about corporate venture, we've had a couple of kind of models of CVC on the podcast, you know, most famously, I guess, Founders Factory, which is one of the accelerators out here in mm-hmm. London. But if I think about corporate venture, you tend to see two things. So to your point, there's the theater of innovation, right? So you have, you know, you have a head of innovation that goes out looking for cool stuff and trying to integrate it into the corporation, but there seems to be too much disconnect between what the business needs and what the what the innovation is trying to do, right? And that's the kind of theatrical side. You then have a semi-theatrical side where you have standalone CVCs, so actual venture funds or off-balance sheet funds, I guess, within the corporation that go out and directly invest in some of these startups, but not necessarily from the perspective of bringing them into the mothership, maybe is the best way of putting it. So really looking at it from a financial returns perspective. And then you have, what I think you're describing, which is actually corporations rolling up their sleeves and saying, right, we want to be innovative. We understand that we don't necessarily have the culture or the skills or expertise to do that in the right way. So how do we bring that, that talent in? How do we bring that technology in? And how do we work closer with it? So I guess my question to you is, you know, are these Fortune 100, Fortune 500 companies that you're working with, are they essentially scouting for companies that they think could be the next wave of technology that could disrupt themselves from inside? The obvious example that's always given is Kodak, you know, not having been, you know, having found, the digital camera and then shelved it. Are they looking for that next wave of innovation that's going to disrupt themselves, or are they essentially taking lots of bets and then seeing, you know, how those might be integrated? Talk me through how that works.
Yeah, lots to unpack there and talk about, right? But I think your characterization of the corporations is right. They tend to make it a sort of side project, or they just don't seem to have the ethos in order to bring it in, to bring ventures into the corporation. And when they bring in they take the VP of X and make him the VP of venturing and say, you should do this, he or she is still part of the behemoth, right? Part of the culture, part of the process,
part of the DNA, yeah.
Right, part of the DNA, really, of the corporation. So they're stuck in sort of, they're trying to be entrepreneurial, they're trying to engage, but the fact is they keep getting pulled back into the corporation and because of all the traditional ways the corporations think. And so it's our belief that you have to get outside that. You have to find a way to do it and bring in entrepreneurial spirit into the corporation that's different than what is internally done. As it relates to investing, too often corporations will only make a couple bets, right? They'll say, well, we found this technology. Everyone loves it. It's cool in the market. Let's invest $2-3 million. Mm. And when you make those large bets, even if you're making 3 or 4 or 10 of them, you're starting to think about the financial in a real significant way, right? All of a sudden the CFO is involved or the investment committee of the board is involved. It's okay, well, we're making these investments. And they worry too much about, did it return to me an X number, whatever the return profile? Did I get my 2X, 10X, whatever it is? Am I on the cutting edge? And we fundamentally believe that just is a recipe for disaster, that those will, at best, they return 5X and were in a tremendously hitting a home run for the most part. They hit 4 or 5X. You take $30 million, you return 120 over 10 years. You're a $10 billion corporation. What do you care, right? Mm. It's not even worth the time to think about it. As opposed to, what if you could make those bets and build an ecosystem that thought about it from a perspective, okay, I still want my 100 or 120 million, but I want to drive $1 billion in top line through the relationships that come with those investments. And I think that's a much different mindset, a much different goal that can have a real impact on the corporations going forward, especially for corporations that we fundamentally believe in. And it's a bold statement that corporations are dying, right? Not corporations, all of them. But the fact of the matter is, if you look at the stock market, half or the Fortune 500, half of them were not there 15 years ago, and half of them will not be there in 15 years.
And that cycle is reducing. I can't remember now. I saw a chart a while ago, but you know, corporations used to exist for minimum 50, 60, 100 years or whatever. That now average time has shrunk down 30, 50, you know, 15 years or whatever it is. So
you're right on the money. Yeah. It was 50 years for half the corporate Fortune 500 to turn over. Now it's 15 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so they have to look and say, are we going to be, are we just going to hoard cash and die? And or are we going to think about how we sustain ourselves and revive ourselves and think about being innovative and tackling new markets, et cetera?
Yeah. So the question that comes out of that for me, I've never been a CFO in a Fortune 500 or Fortune 100 company. I'm not sure that I have the I definitely don't think I have the DNA for that, or the appetite, maybe, if I can put it that way. But so for you at TechNexus, presumably part of how you have to deal with that is educating the CFO and the board and stakeholders out of that mindset of overly focusing on immediate or proximate ROI versus actually, if you look at the bigger picture, this thing in 10 years will make sure that the business sustains for the next 15, 20, 30 years, right? Like, how do you approach that? Because surely that's like, I mean, yes, you can educate, you can talk about those things, but getting buy-in must be incredibly difficult.
Well, first thing is you don't start with CFO, because if you start with the CFO, you're dead
You're
meat,
dead.
right? You're never going to get anywhere, right? They just don't, and that's their job, is to manage cash in a very conservative way, or at least a good one does. Do we generally go with someone who's a rising CEO? We try and find those two or three people within the corporation who were at the C-suite, who probably are one of the next few people to be the CEO, who are saying, I'm putting forth an agenda to think about the future of the corporation, and this is a way to do it. This is a way to easily, not easily, but simply, in a cost-effective way, get things going. Because our first set of investments we do with any corporation is not, hey, give us $100 million, although we've done that too, but it's more of, hey, give us $10-15 million, let's go make 30 bets, and we can talk more about our philosophy on investing if you like, and make those 30 bets and use that as a seedling or a seed or fostering the field to drive going forward. So you have to find that person who's engaged, who's thinking about the future of the company, thinking about themselves also, and then incorporate it into the rest. I can tell you though, the boards are actually the easier group to understand, because the board is looking and saying, what are you doing to drive this
Longer
in
term
new and
strategic.
innovative way and be strategic? And this and so they're a big advocate. So it's finding that CEO, getting some board members involved, few people, then go to the CFO and say, let me show you how we're going to do this smarter, different, and not make it a burden to you as either a public or private company.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that makes a lot of sense. And we will talk about the investment thesis as well. But, kind of, I guess a tangential point, or like a related but tangential point, is that you've mentioned that venture capital has been broken for the last 40
Yeah.
years. Can you elaborate on the specific issues you see within traditional VC models that you
Well, if you
think are
go back to,
flawed?
yeah, if you go back to the history of the VC industry in the 70s or the 60s, 70s, 80s, it was very much about how do we invest in things to drive key needs for the economy, key needs for manufacturing, to building the future of, and stay with America, right? The future of America at the time. I think venture capital along the way basically became poker, right? It was let's bet, or blackjack's maybe better analogy. Let's bet on a bunch of things. It doesn't matter if we lose half our stack. If I win the last hand and it gives it to me, it's great. And that is not a sustainable lifestyle or a sustainable business model. The return profile of venture capitalists, while still good, and they still most venture a lot of venture capitalists make money, most do not, right?
Yeah, I mean,
Most are still about,
average is 1.4x or 1.8x
right?
return, and that's average. So you have a huge number below 1x return, and obviously the outlier funds that really outperform.
But even the outliers are, they've got one or two wins and then eight failures or eight sort of mediocre things. That just isn't a good, if you play any sport, that's not a really good way to do it. And they bet on things that just don't matter. I mean, do we really need another dating app? Do we really, is that really where we want to spend $100 million on the next dating app? And you can frankly see a little bit going on right now. I mean, we're throwing trillion billions hundreds of billions of dollars, not tr trillion dollars, into AI. And if you looked at look at what's needed to sustain that, it's a 600 or $6 trillion in revenue, or some sort of six, I'm sorry, $600 trillion in revenue to support that investment. It doesn't make any sense, as opposed to a model where it says, okay, I'm going to invest in things that evolve, change what's already out there, or provide some great new thing that allows the corporation or the ideas or the networks that are already out there to be better, faster, stronger, and smarter.
Yeah.
And that's sort of our philosophy.
Yeah. I mean, I think
is
I think the so what I talk about a fair amount or have been recently is what I've seen, certainly in the UK, Europe, I think in the US, maybe from a couple of years ago as well, is a move back towards very R&D heavy projects.
Yeah.
As opposed to your point, the next, you know, spreadsheet with a front end or a 15-minute grocery delivery or whatever was the flavor du jour, right? But right now we're seeing a lot in space tech, deep tech, defense, supply chain, logistics, you know, in sensors. And you know, if you, to your point, if you go back to the history of, you know, the history of venture capital as it is today, it came out of the semiconductor industry, and that, you know, that was forging the next generation of corporate, you know, resilience within the US.
Right.
And, you know, I think you'd be hard pressed to argue whether a to-do list, you know, is fostering that same sort of growth or same sort of potential. So I'm quite, and I think this happened after, you know, when there was cheap money, I think everyone was just throwing it everywhere. I think when interest rates obviously started to climb, I think this return back to that kind of ethos of no, we're going to invest in like generational businesses that have the ability to change or impact the world in very outsized ways because they are very heavily R&D focused, life sciences, biotech, etc. You know, I think that's really positive.
I think you're right on, right spot on, right? I think that external R&D is a way to think about it for corporations,
yeah,
and a way to think about venture capital going forward, especially in a movement in which being or working in a corporation is no longer their end all be all, right? It was, did you get a job at X? Did you get a job at Citibank? Did you get a job at Microsoft 20, 30 years ago? The next generation of workers just saying, I want more flexibility. I want to be able to do my own thing. I want to be able to take my ideas, and I'm happy to implement them or put them into the corporation as if it makes sense over time, but I don't want to be the person working for that corporation from the get-go. So,
and I also want skin in the game, right?
Right. Yeah, you know, that's an interesting question. I think certainly that's a Silicon Valley mentality or West Coast mentality. I'm not sure that mentality holds true everywhere, right? I think people just want a good job, be able to express their ideas, and many will take cash over, we've seen many will take cash over long-term compensation. That's a different risk profile.
Also
listen, I have one who as I like to say, I spent my entire life not trying to have a boss, right? And I haven't had one for a long time. And so most people don't like that though. And so it's changing. But I think you're right. I think that is an external RT. And the corporations that say, okay, I'm going to embrace that. I'm going to think about, instead of, oh, I have all the answers, but look, there's hundreds, thousands, dozens of companies, hundreds of thousand people that are going to be part of my thing that I can tap into. Mm. They're the smart ones who are thinking about it in very forward ways.
Yeah. So I think that raises, I think actually, look, and I think in Europe, this is probably more so the case. I mean, people have over-indexed towards equity compensation. But in Europe, we're not seeing the sort of returns or the sort of exits, rather, that would lead to, you know, any of those equity positions being actually that valuable. Both the frequency of it happening, but also the size of it.
Right.
Unlike the US, where you have, you know, more sort of large scale outcomes, or have had historically larger scale outcomes. And again, I mean, you know, and actually UK venture and UK kind of venture employees are probably like quite correlated in their risk aversion, right? So, and I think I would agree, like most people actually, if they are earning a decent paycheck that they can, you know, that their lives are comfortable and they can do the things that they want to do and are happy at work, I guess is the other point, right? Are happy to continue to do that. They don't, not everyone wants to or needs to be an entrepreneur, I guess is the point, but that doesn't preclude you from being entrepreneurial in your job, right?
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some great stats if you look at NVIDIA right now, right? NVIDIA, obviously a 30-year-old company, has all of a sudden become the at least as of a few days ago, the most valuable company in the world. And there's all these stories about these employees who've been there 10 years who are like, all of a sudden, I never thought I'd be rich on the equity, and all of a sudden now I'm a multimillionaire. What do I do? Their example of, they were thinking about it from a job perspective, from doing good work, from growing the future, not about equity, and now they're benefiting. That's great for them, but I think they're of likely a lot of the mindset these days. It doesn't mean there aren't people out there say, I want to become a billionaire, be Gates or Bezos or whoever, but I think it's not as frequent as everyone thinks.
Yeah, and I think there is also, and I think, look, I mean, I think the business of venture has propagated a little bit this, I don't want to call it a fantasy because obviously it does happen, but obviously everyone is out there reaching for that $1 billion exit and, you know, tens or hundreds of millions of returns for themselves and other stakeholders. But obviously, as you and I both know, and I think as many people that would listen to this podcast understand, that is an infinitesimal kind of fraction of the number of startups that get launched, right? So so ultimately it is, you're taking a very huge bet. And I think the thing, I mean, I think founders do understand this, but you know, there is this tension between venture, which obviously takes a portfolio approach, versus venture to a founder, which is no, you must be in that business and only do that. Which means that you are betting the farm essentially on your one business potentially, right? So, but yeah, I mean, but I think if we move forward to a world where people have that, I don't know what the right word is that I'm looking for, but they have that security and that sense of fulfillment, right, maybe is the right way of putting it, in their jobs, then actually they'd be happy to develop for the corporation, even if it doesn't mean the $1 billion exit for them.
Right. The other part is funny is, you know, I'm curious these days, this is a thought I've had, is how many people think of being an Instagram influencer as more of a greater way to make wealth than to work at a startup company, right?
Well, the stats clearly show
that whole
what...
category created, right? Everyone thinks, yeah, of Kim Kardashian, as opposed to they think about themselves as the next great Gates or Bezos, as I mentioned, Zuckerberg.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the stats, you know, that came out relatively recently, like, you know, several months ago, maybe now. But the number one, you know, job that I think Gen Zers were looking for was to be a YouTube influencer of some nature, or a YouTube or whatever, right? And
God help us all.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. I mean, I'm sure they'll learn. So it is not that easy, guys. It really is not. I recently gained, internet personality on my Google profile somehow or the other, and I've got no idea what it means. But I'm telling you now, it doesn't earn you any money. So it's not necessarily the thing you should be shooting for. So moving on, you advocate for the fact that ventures should be seen as opportunities rather than threats. What do you specifically mean by that? And are you able to provide examples of how you've been able to successfully turn those potential threats into opportunities?
Certainly. So I think corporations, if you talk to an average corporation, a corporation executive, they'll say, oh, well, one, we have all the answers, right? We're big, we're historical, we have the network, we have the people, we have all the answers. And so they tended to look at ventures as sort of, well, they might needle us a little bit, and so I'm not going to help them grow because they're going to get in my way. As opposed to, hey, do they have an idea that's helpful that could help drive where we're going as a corporation, and where in partnership something magical could happen? So I give lots of examples in that space, but I'll turn to one around electrification. So one of our partners is a large boat maker, and they, if you asked them 5 years ago, whether electrification was going to be part of their product portfolio, they would have said, no way, right? You can't put electric motors in the water. Gas motors work great. We've been doing this for 100 years. Don't talk to us. I'm being a little bit facetious, but basically they're sort of, we're very much like, I don't think it's going to work.
Same mentality mm-hmm. as like horse and carriage versus the car, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. And so looked at electric sort of like a nuance or maybe a threat, but we're not going to support it because we've done it the way we've done it this way. We were able to help them invest in a number of companies in that space, engage a broader ecosystem, even ones they weren't engaged in, draw the insight from all the things that were going on. And now they have a product portfolio of 8 electric motors that are really great motors, that are really innovative, that are really about the future of where boating is going in a real way, in a real fast motors, not sort of piddly little things that you add to a fishing boat, but these sort of high-end motors. And if you would ask that question 6 years ago, they would have said, probably the rising CEO would have said, yeah, I see it. But if you ask the engineers in the motors, they would have said, no, it'll never happen. we anticipate, and I have no idea what they think the projections are, and I wouldn't say because they're a public company if I did, but certainly it's an amazing product, and they're putting new ones in the market all the time. It's one example of where they always look at these new things as sort of they're just out of the scope of even their mentality.
So let me just ask you a quick question there, right? So firstly, you describe them as a fairly stuck in their ways organization, it sounds like, right? So how did you get them over the line of, okay, no, we do need to think about what we do next, and actually we should start thinking about this? And how did you drive, because I guess you have to drive that culturally through the whole organization that, we're going to move in
Yes.
this direction.
Listen, I'm going to be clear. I'm not saying that it was entirely us that got them to think about election. The
Sure,
only
for
reason they
sure.
have it is us, that we're a needle, right? I look at my job as an agitator. I look at our team's job as an agitator. It's to take the information in the market, show what's happening, see the venture activity happening globally, and saying, you need to pay attention to this because it's not one little thing that's going to affect you. It's dozens, hundreds of companies that are coming after you in your marketplace. And if you don't think about it, they're just going to leapfrog you. And so it's around providing that information, being a needle, being an entrepreneur, right? I don't have time for, you don't know me well, but if you don't have time, I have no patience for bullshit, right? I'm like, what are we going to do and how are we going to get there? And I think it takes that CEO, in this case, that was the man who was the CTO, who is now the CTO, Dave Foulkes, who understood the technology, saw where the future was going, and said, I need to bring this into the organization. We need to find ways to make it to bring in and build relationships. It was not easy. It's still never easy, but saw it as a way to drive the future, the company forward. So it's finding that champion. It's having them, with our assistance, engage a broader audience and drive towards the future. No pun intended.
Yeah, no, I think that makes sense, and it has to be that holistic approach. And I think the what you're talking about is identifying the directionality, right? Identifying where where the future could go. I mean, it's like I interviewed someone this morning, and the way he described it, he's building. I mean, he's been a very successful entrepreneur in his own right in the past, but he's building services. He calls it services as software businesses, where he's basically building AI agents for SMEs. And he goes into a room and he'll ask the attendees, how many of you are using ChatGPT or Claude or Perplexity or whatever whatever LLM tool of your choice? How many of you are using that in your kind of day-to-day lives? And you get like 5% of people raise their hands. And he goes, the analogy that he says to them is, guys, it's like you're going into into an MMA fight against a big hulking MMA professional who understands karate and kung fu and God knows what else. And you've got Iron Man, sitting behind you saying, hey, I can tap in for you. And you saying, no, it's okay, I don't know how to use you, so I'm not going to do it. I think people who will, and the corporations who embrace that uncertainty of the future, right, and do something about it, are the ones that will win, right? Because the longer you stay incumbent, the more chance there is that you're going to be disrupted.
But also, yes, that's correct. But also, our philosophy is you shouldn't bet on one Iron Man. You should bet on all the
Got
superheroes,
it.
right?
Got it.
So a lot of corporations will say, okay, I'm going to bet on Iron Man because that's the one I see in front of me, as opposed to let's go invest in or build a relationship with dozens of Iron Mans, dozens of superheroes across multiple themes to figure out what really will stick, what's going to work, what's going to be the best for us going forward. No one has that answer. There's no prescribed method to say this is absolutely the choice. It's around making those investments broadly, and we believe at a smaller level. So one of the things we haven't talked about is corporations tend to, as I said, make bigger bets, but why can't you make small bets to begin the relationship? Why do you have to kiss? Why can't you go out for coffee or kiss before you get married?
Yeah, I mean, and there's two things there, right? So one, it drives also potential interoperability between those company between those innovative technologies, right? So you might be able to find synergies with a dozen, rather than if you're just betting, again, betting the farm on one. But the second thing is, and to your point around the size of the check, the problem often becomes for some of these startups, they're hesitant to take a large check from a corporate because it signals to the rest of the market, well, okay, I'm going to end up being absorbed or hired or acquired or bought out by these guys, and it limits upside. Whereas actually, if you take that small bet approach, it's, you know, yes, you're a line on the cap table, but you're not a big line, and therefore potentially, you know, you leave the doors open. And again, you know, if that business is not of direct value to the corporation, you've taken the venture bet, which is, okay, it may still be a value to someone else.
Right, as opposed to just spending the money on a pilot, yeah. You know, is going to go out the door anyways. I think the other part of that is, you know, part of why we work, I think, is that we make those investments, not the corporation. Now the corporation's behind us, and if you look under the covers, you're going to see who our partner is. But for the most part, that we're a buffer to help make sure that the corporation doesn't smother the startup.
Yeah.
And for the startup to help to work with the corporation in a meaningful way, because they're obviously trying to do a million things, and they can't do everything, but we can be an assistant in that going forward. I think also by making a number of vets, at least in our philosophy, you create if you do it well, you create an entrepreneurial army. Mm. That army then is supporting that corporation in a meaningful way because they all see it going together collectively towards something valuable. And that can be very strong for the corporation to say, we're not alone doing our thing. We've got this army out there in the new and innovative spaces that are supporting us.
Yeah. And it's a great way to hunt for talent. It's a great way, you know, to further, because again, we all know that this stuff compounds, right? Like the product that you invest in today isn't the product that the business necessarily turns out tomorrow. You actually may, you know, you may see a better product fit, you know, after the experimentation phase, let's put it that way, compared to what you thought you were investing in the first place. You may actually have a better outcome, right? This has been really interesting. I do want to kind of finish off the podcast with one question I've been asking of late, which is what is one thing that you have a contrarian conviction about from any area of life, whether that's work, probably not politics as we've discussed already, but socially or at home? What is the hill that you would die on defending?
Well, it's interesting that you asked that question because I'm not sure in today's environment there is a contrarian opinion, right? I mean,
maybe that is a contrarian opinion.
There's so many viewpoints out there, and so on everything from what type of bagel is the best to how we do geopolitical politics, right? There, it's no longer a situation where there's standards. Right? It's no longer a situation where there is a common view on things. So I'm not sure I can have a contrarian view on anything because of that, and maybe that's a cheap answer to your question, but I can I can probably give you more things like, I believe in execution is more important than the ideas, right? Things like that. And there's people who believe in ideas. You know, I believe the Pacific Ocean is the greatest ocean in the world, even though it's cold, right? Stupid things like that, right? I believe the relationship with God is about a person, not about an institution, whatever, right? You pick lots of things. Yeah. But I don't know if it's possible to have a contrarian view anymore because there's so many views presented.
But then, I mean, then what do VCs do, right? Because like that's their entire shtick is that they are the contrarians in an uncontrarian world. No, I think the contrarian the contrarian view is that as you say, can you really have a contrarian view in today's world?
Right. I mean, my view is just to be, you know, is a contrarian to say that we think we have an outsourced R&D company that's better for you through the venture than it is by yourself? Okay, maybe, but who knows? I mean, I'll if you need a contrarian view to corporations, absolutely. I am the one who says you are silly, you are stupid, you are going to die if you don't engage external venturing, whether through me or any way in an effective way.
That's just good strategy. That's just good strategy, to be honest. that is something I think more corporations probably need to hear. Fred, it's been absolutely wonderful having you on the podcast today. For the audience, where's the best place for them to find you online? Are you on LinkedIn, Twitter? Where can they?
Yeah, I'm on technexus.com. You can find us. You can find me on Twitter at Fred Hoch. Fred Hoch on Twitter. You can find me on LinkedIn at Fred Hoch, H-O-C-H. Anybody, feel free to give me a call, reach out. I'm always open to opportunities and love to talk to people. So Fred at TechNexus, if you want to go to technexus.com, if you want to get a hold of me.
Amazing. Fred, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciated the conversation and really appreciate you turning
Great
up.
Great talking to you too.
Amazing. Thank you.
Cheers.